Hello.
Hi.
How
Good. How are you?
are you? Good. Good.
Let me figure out how to do this Zoom thing.
Okay. Hi, Emily. We're just going to play around and see how our screen sharing works and stuff. So just hang tight. Let's see. So I need
That's fine. I just logged in really early, currently.
I
Just
get
thinking.
it. Okay, so I think if I make you a co-host, then you should be able to share your screen.
Okay. Do you
So
want
I
me
made
to
you.
try or have you, or are you still doing that?
One participant can share at a time. Okay, so I made you a co-host. Do you want to try to share screen at the bottom?
Did it work? Hello?
Okay, so I think since you are the co-host, that's why it was able to keep you on when I got kicked out. And to me a couple times. So even if I get kicked out, it looks like your skin is still be good to go.
Okay.
I don't know why that happened.
That was odd. Were you able to see the screen share before it kicked you out?
Yes.
Okay. It looked all right. It worked all right. Okay, Jackie, I'm going to try to go without camera and see if maybe that's my camera that's kicking me off. But you are a co-host, so you should be good to go. Once we get started, I'll introduce you, and then you're off to the races. Sounds good.
Okay, everybody, it's 1:30, so let's go ahead and get started. Today, you are joining Psychological First Aid with Ms. Jackie Macer. She is here to talk about Psychological First Aid and recovering from crisis. So we are just kicking this off. Welcome to Cougar Tales, fully on Cougar Tales. And if you have questions along the way, put them in the chat. We are asking that you keep your videos and your microphones off just for maintaining the most streamlined version of Zoom that we can while we're on here. We've got quite the crowd, 44 people checked so far. And like I said, if you have questions, put them in the chat and we will just jump in and ask them as we go. It's good to see everybody.
Okay, can everybody hear me okay and see everything okay? Yes? Wonderful. Thanks, Joe. So I'm going to talk to you guys today about psychological first aid. And first, I have a confession, which is that when we talked about topics for this session, it was in the spring, and clearly I was a little overly optimistic about where we would be at in terms of the recovering from the pandemic. So I have updated the title of this from recovering after a crisis to supporting through a crisis. I think we're recovering in a lot of ways, but certainly we're still kind of in the throes of it too. And that does change how we're going to provide psychological first aid, where we're at in that phase, those phases as we're going through a crisis or a disaster situation. So psychological first aid, or PFA, as I might refer to it as we're going along, basically it's supporting people through a period of distress or traumatic stress, and then you're going to evaluate if they need a higher level of care, and then you're going to help to provide access to that care. Those are the three main things you're learning how to do. Support, evaluate, and refer, essentially. So that's what I'm hoping to kind of teach you guys today as we're going through that, is how to do those three things. Traumatic stress is not a mental illness, and I want to emphasize that. It's an ordinary reaction to an extraordinary event, just like grief is an ordinary reaction to somebody close to you passing away. So even though it feels out of the ordinary for us, it is not considered a mental illness. And for that reason, the things that I'm going to teach you about providing support does not entail any kind of diagnosis or treatment or anything like that. It's just kind of your basics. And that's, of course, it's also a form of crisis intervention, because that's when you're going to use it most often. We use it a lot with any kind of disasters, whether it's epidemics, pandemics, whether it's tornadoes, hurricanes, mass shootings, just anything like that. These types of teams go in and apply these skills to help people recover from that. Okay, so there isn't a blanket way to help everyone. You have to take the time to listen to that person so that you can help them from where they are at. Not everyone needs the same level of care. Some people may be extremely distressed by what's going on right now. Some people may be moderately, and some people may just be flat out annoyed by the whole situation and not want to talk about it anymore. They're over it. They don't want any more to do with this. So if you're going to help, you have to kind of determine where that person's at so that you can provide the adequate kind of support. So that's where I have this quote here that I just really love about, before you can lead anyone to a specific place, you have to find him where he is and begin there. Something I want to kind of caution about right now is the tendency to what I'll call over-empathizing. And what is over, and we hear all about under-empathizing. We don't hear about over-empathizing that much, but over-empathizing is kind of projecting our own worries, anxieties, and fears onto everyone else and assuming that they feel the same way. And we have to be kind of cautious about that right now, since we are all kind of in this situation together and facing the same stressors. We don't want to project that onto someone who maybe isn't feeling that same way. So, you know, I'll give you an example. If you're very stressed and you're talking to a student and you're, you know, saying things like, oh, I know this sucks. We just got to get through this semester and hang in there. And we got 2 weeks down, you know, however many more to go, just let's get through there. Well, that student may actually be feeling pretty good about being back here, and they were excited, and you've just really put kind of a negative light on being here. And that's actually going to make their worry and their stress worse instead of helping it. In my coping with stress class that I had this summer, my students do a journal where they talk about the stressors they feel throughout the week. And this last couple semesters, we added a section for COVID where they could talk about specific COVID-related stressors, and then they rated their stress throughout the week. And then they practiced different coping skills and stuff like that and talk about how that helped. What was really interesting this summer is I have a lot of international students and some that are traveling from far away. And in the last week, as students were coming to campus, and the week before when they were preparing to come to campus, their stress levels, they rated much lower because they were excited to get back to campus. They were looking forward to a sense of normalcy and feeling like things were moving forward. Their life was moving forward. And so their stress levels were actually quite a bit down. The ones who reported their stress levels being much higher were the ones who were not being able to go back to school. Maybe they're getting ready to transfer, and where they were going wasn't letting them come to the actual campus, and they were having to wait till spring, or they were having to go remote. Those people were significantly more stressed in their levels because they continue to feel held back by COVID. So just kind of some perspective on how some students may be happy to be here, and they may be getting a sense of normalcy and actually feeling better about it. So if you're anxious, try not to assume that they're feeling that way too. So psychological first aid, there are goals of psychological first aid, and then there's the actions of how we meet those goals. The goals are meeting basic needs, stabilizing acute psychological and behavioral reactions. Basically, that's a fancy word for if someone is having a panic attack, or they're just really having a behavioral, you know, freaking out a little bit, helping them to calm down and get in a good spot in that moment, teaching resiliency, coping skills, and then helping them to find continued care. And so how we do that, as you can see over here in the actions section, we have comfort, consolation, physical protection, physical necessities, reuniting victims with families. The verbiage here refers more to, you know, if you're in a natural disaster or something like that. But in our case, making sure and encouraging students to stay connected with families and to stay connected with friends and get that social support in the best way that they can. Allowing people to vent their frustrations and helping to establish a sense of security. I think that's the biggest challenge that we're all kind of facing, is that sense of safety and security throughout this. But just focusing on the things that they can do and that are within all of our control is going to be the only way that we can help establish something that resembles safety and security. And then utilizing social community support networks and knowing how to refer. So you need to know, wherever you are location-wise, who do you refer to? If someone is very distressed, if they're not in a good space, where can you send them? A lot of you are gonna, if you're here at Great Bend, you're probably gonna send them to me, but even I have a list of people outside of me that I send to too, and I pull that out and I just have it in my desk at all times, and it's like 5-6 different places that I can refer them to as well if they need even more support. So it's definitely a handy thing to just keep on you. Also, if anybody has questions, feel free as we're going along to type them in the box, and Carly will let me know. Okay. So if you don't know who Carl Rogers is, Carl Rogers is to mental health counseling like Freud is to the field of psychology. And if you don't know who Freud is, I can't help you. It's probably your mother's fault. Somebody out there got that, I hope. But he's kind of like the king of counseling. And he says that there are three things required to provide psychological support. So in order for you to be effective at providing psychological first aid, these three things need to be present. Number one, and most importantly, two or more people need to be present, and one of those people needs to have less need for psychological support than the other at that moment in time. This is probably the biggest difference in what we're facing now than what normal people providing psychological first aid would have to face. Typically, let's say we have a natural disaster. Let's say there's a hurricane. We're going to send people to provide psychological first aid from a different part of the country who are not affected by that hurricane because psychologically they're in a much better position to provide support. But we're all being affected by this, and that makes it uniquely hard for us to provide that support to others when we all kind of need it ourselves, right? So you have to really be keen at self-evaluating and knowing whether or not you're in a worse spot than the person you're talking to and who is needing support. If you're more anxious or more fearful than they are, then you need to get them to someone else who can provide that support. And probably also maybe find somebody for you that can provide that kind of support. The person with less needs for psychological support needs to genuinely care about the other person whose need is greater. So you can't, it's not like a fake it till you make it kind of deal. You have to actually care about them being stressed out. And that can be hard sometimes, depending on what they're stressed out about. I'm sure as we all know, but when it's like a Facebook thing or like a tweet that they're mad about and you're like, I really care about this, but they are gonna know if it's not genuine. And then the person with the greater need has to be aware that the other person cares. So they need to feel it from you. They need to know it and feel it from you. So they did kind of a survey of people who had received psychological first aid over a 15-year span, and they asked them what the number one factor was that made them receptive to receiving it. And it was what they call the approachability factor. So whether or not that person believes that you are friendly, trustworthy, and authentic. And friendliness, I mean, obviously you're going to put that off. Trustworthiness, if you have, that's going to be based off your previous encounters with this person. If you don't have previous encounters with this person, it's going to be based a lot off just your reputation and whether or not people perceive and tell each other that you're a trustworthy person. And then authenticity, again, if people don't feel that you're genuine and that you genuinely care, they can feel that and they're not going to be receptive to you. Okay. So a unique problem that we have lots of unique problems that we're facing, but another unique problem that we have is that you may also be put into a position to provide support to someone who has very different views than yours. A lot of things with this pandemic have turned very political, as we all know, and it can be very difficult to have conversations with someone and to provide support to someone who has a very different political stance than you, a very different interpretation of what's going on than you. But I'm going to kind of let you in on a little secret of how I deal with that, because believe it or not, counselors and therapists, we all have opinions, political, personal opinions, and we have tons and tons of clients who we don't agree with at all, but we still have to be able to support and help that person. So the visualization or this mental strategy that I use with that, I think some of you can relate to. It's kind of about compartmentalizing and turning your cerebral brain on, and the emotional brain off. We're going to kind of like switch gears, you know, from the back to the front. And I think of it as, when I look at this, when I have this person who's talking to me about this stressor, I think of it as learning a new concept in class. I'm studying this person like I'm studying a new concept in class that I don't understand and I've never learned before. So if you're in class and you are sitting in the classroom trying to learn this concept, what's the number one thing you probably need to be doing in order to learn in the classroom? Listening, probably. Listening to what they say. And then asking questions. And being genuinely curious, right? Those are probably some of the three top things in a classroom that someone needs to do to learn. And so I'm thinking of it the same way. I'm trying to learn this concept, this person. So I'm going to listen. I'm going to ask questions. And I'm going to be genuinely curious. And if you can look at things in that way of, let's say this is someone who is really upset that they have to wear a mask, for example. They hate masks. It's really stressing them out. They're upset about it. And let's say that you are very pro mask, like you would sleep in the thing if you didn't have sleep apnea. You are all about the masks. You're frustrated, but you're trying to listen to their perspective on this. So look at it as, okay, this is a concept I don't understand. I don't understand how someone's frustrated about this or why they wouldn't want to. So I'm just going to try to learn this person's perspective on, how do you get to have that view? How do you get to be frustrated about something like that? Why is this so troublesome for them? And you're just trying to understand their position. You're not trying to change their minds. You're not trying to be emotionally reactive. You're just trying to understand this person or this concept that you don't understand. Okay, so the John Hopkins public health perspective says that in the wake of disasters, there will be three different dynamics that always come into play. The first is that mental health casualties would far outnumber physical casualties, depending on the cause of the disaster. So the thing about this is that the mental health part of the effect of mental health on people going through disasters carries on for a long time after the disaster is over. So once this, you know, the pandemic is wrapping up and we're not seeing the deaths and the suffering that we're seeing now, that's when a lot of the mental health stuff is really going to kick in. That's when the stress really hits people as they go into acceptance and moving on. There's kind of that delayed reaction. So we have a much longer period of time where people are mentally being affected by a crisis. And, you know, as I'm sure many of you have seen, suicide rates and attempts are up. They will stay up. Substance abuse is up, domestic violence is up. And so those casualties over such a long period of time get to add up to a really big number. Psychological distress is potentially contagious. I think we can all relate to being around someone that's very stressed out about everything. And then by the time you leave, you're kind of like stressed out about everything too. And it's just, it rubs off on you. And sometimes we have to mitigate that a little bit. If there's an employee or a student that is just real worked up about things and real scared to be in class or at work, sometimes it's better to, you know, accommodate or arrange with that person. Like maybe to, you know, maybe you work in a different location, like remotely, or maybe you take the class online, or you do something to accommodate that, because not only is it going to help that person, but it's going to help that distress from spreading to the rest of your department or your classroom. And so it's always worth kind of taking that into consideration. And then three is that there's a distinct shortage of mental health professionals to provide psychological services. So people, specifically educators and emergency services personnel, need to be trained. We know that that's true, and that's why we're doing this today, really. Alrighty. So after a crisis, we have these reaction phases that happen as we go on this road to recovery. The first phase is a hero phase, and that's kind of everyone, all hands on deck, trying to save the sinking ship, right, and help each other out. The honeymoon phase is when we kind of recognize like how much work everyone's putting in. We're so thankful. You know, there's a lot of cohesion and camaraderie. And then we move into disillusionment, which is where you realize the magnitude of the loss that's been experienced, and then reconstruction, accepting the losses and building a new normal, which I don't know about you guys, but I am so tired of the word new normal. But I couldn't think of another expression to put there, so that's what we got. But if you had to guess, where would you think that we would be at right now as a college community in these stages? Anyone want to throw something in the chat? Carly, can you see my chat? Because I can't pull it up.
Yes, it looks like we have between disillusionment and reconstruction. We have a couple of agreements with that. One saying the honeymoon and another saying in disillusionment still.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All great guesses.
So Annika says all phases at different times.
Great. Well, A plus sticker for you. Goodness gracious. So once again, another unique thing about being in such a prolonged crisis situation is that normally these phases, they are in a direct line. You move from one to the next as you go through recovery. But because this is a situation that is so drawn out and evolving and changing all the time, we're stuck more in this little loop here where we get through this phase, we move on to this one, and then something happens and we've got to start over and we go through this again and again and again. And doing that, going through this process, is just extremely psychologically and physically draining, because that means your nervous system is just all the time. It's not getting to settle down. So we're just in this weird cycle that we're kind of dealing with here. And it can be a personal thing, like you may be personally moving on to another cycle and someone else is not, or it can be a collective as a group, how you're functioning together. So there's a number of factors that contribute to how much psychological impact something's going to have on someone. Some of those are the length of the disaster. We just talked about how that's a huge difference here in our situation. The number of deaths, and also I would say the proximity of those deaths to you. You're a little more stressed out if it's, you know, if grandma has COVID as opposed to nobody you know has COVID and it's not as close to you. The extent of the devastation, whether it occurred with or without warning, unknown causation. This is where we get into conspiracy theories, things like that. People looking for ways to understand and kind of place blame. And it's extremely normal for when we have something happen that makes us lose our sense of kind of safety and security. We want to get that back so that we can feel more normal again. And the best way to get that back is if we know what caused it, then we can keep it from happening again. So people might turn to conspiracy theories. They might, you know, formulate their own opinions, or they might really heavily place blame on one party or another, because in some way that's offering them some kind of security or safety. Management of disaster relief operations and the communication by officials, I'm gonna lump those together. That can be at a small level, that can be, how our college has managed disaster relief operations, how our officials have communicated to us. It can be how the county, the state, or the United States has communicated to us. So we're gonna have different feelings about different levels on how things were handled. And that's gonna contribute to our stress. If you feel like things were handled poorly, that's going to create a lot of kind of animosity and issues. And then whether families are separated, you know, we'll probably see an increase in students that are far away from home, or that are, you know, international students, things like that, are gonna experience some more distress than maybe ones that are close by. Not only because their safety and security is more threatened not having their family to support them, but they can't help their family if they need to. And that's, you know, hard. So I have a photo here of the Maslow's hierarchy of needs, which hopefully most of us know what that is. And if you don't, we have basic needs that need to be met. And before we can focus on the next level here, these need to be met. And then before we can focus on this level, these need to be met. And most of us kind of hang out around this area most of the time. But right now, most of us are down here. And this causes a whole plethora of issues. You know, this is why we focus on basic needs first. Do whoever is distressed, do they have food, water, rest, all of those things? If they're getting that, rest is one we overlook a lot. But if people are working all the time or just, you know, drive, and they're not resting themselves, then those basic needs are not being met. Safety and security, obviously, this is where most of us are going to be struggling, students and employees alike. And then we get up to the belonging and love needs. But this is why a lot of time, right at the beginning of the semesters, we're encouraging students to join groups and socialize and go to activities. Because if students who make friendships and who bond with others tend to do better in class, you know, we know this from research. So we build those relationships so that then they can focus on the esteem needs, which is the feelings of accomplishment, goal setting, things like that. But belonging is in love is going to be a hard thing to fulfill this year with less group activities that we can get people in, just less socialization in general. That's going to make that more difficult. And that's then going to make goal setting and personal accomplishment that much more difficult. So we've kind of got a whole crashing down of the pyramid here. And that's going to present so many unique challenges. When we get to the top here, the self-actualization, a lot of people say nobody ever really achieves fully self-actualization. So it's supposed to be like an achieving of one's full potential, which I kind of think we all always have more potential. So I call this the Michael Jordan category, because I think he's the only person that ever really like maintained and achieved his full potential. Nobody but Michael Jordan goes in this category, I think. If you know somebody else, let me know. Okay. So let's talk about typical stress reactions. It's important for us all to understand that under long-term or traumatic stress, we are all going to be able to do less, to tolerate less, and to be less productive. It's an unavoidable fact. We need to keep it in mind so that we can understand, support, and work cohesively with one another and with our students. There's a saying, expectations are the root of all disappointment. So you have to have realistic or flexible expectations that your students, athletes, coworkers may not be operating at full capacity. They may be more on edge, more irritable, or need more time to decompress than they did before. Other expectations that we can have, I mentioned this earlier about how stress reactions tend to occur months after the event. So, you know, we're going to see it's not uncommon for someone to function totally well for a long time. And then once things are kind of getting back to normal and good, then they have the meltdown. Counselors will say power through so you can power down. And that's kind of what happens. You get through it and then there's that crash there at the end. And then other stressors become more prevalent. I think some of you will not expect this and will be more surprised by this, but if you imagine in your brain that your space for holding stress is a pie, and you've got a slice for your family stress, and you've got a slice for your friends and your community and your work, and you've got a little slice for everything, and they kind of rotate and take up different amounts of space, and you're doing pretty well managing stuff. Now insert COVID, and COVID takes up a big chunk. While you may be handling that chunk really well, but that chunk has taken up the space that was being allotted for family stress and for maybe like handling physical stress. And so now there's no space for that anymore. So the problem that is going to come out is going to be about family matters that maybe weren't bothering you before, or you had under control before, and now all of a sudden you don't, or another category in your life. So when I have people coming to see me, and when you have people coming to see you, it's not necessarily that you're going to have all these people coming and saying, COVID is stressing me out. My stress is through the roof because of the pandemic. It's going to be the same stuff you hear all the time. It's family stress. It's work stress. It's sports stress. It's all of those things. It's just that there's going to be more of it. There's going to be more people with more stress than what you saw before. I hope that makes sense. And I'm sure a lot of us can reflect on that and think about things that we're like, oh yeah, that did kind of happen to me. I noticed this was bothering me more when it I thought I'd moved past that, or I thought it wasn't bothering me, and now it is. You know, we can all probably do that a little bit. Here I have this kind of broken down into some different reactions that we're going to see. Emotional, I think, is fairly obvious. Anxiety, fear, depression, irritability, things like that. Physical reactions, I mentioned earlier how the nervous system is aroused during a crisis. What we deal with now, though, is that the nervous system is aroused constantly. If you're someone that's always on social media, if you're someone that's having this exposure all the time from the news and talking to people about COVID, every time you're doing those things, you're arousing the nervous system and it's not getting a break. And that's kind of unique to our generation. Before social media, there was a break, you know, there was time to not think about it and not hear about it. And now it's just constant. So you have to have those boundaries to not talk about it, to think about other things so that your nervous system can get a break. When your nervous system doesn't get a break, then you start to have all kinds of physical problems, stomach issues. That's really important in children. I had a teacher who used to say, kids don't get anxiety, kids get stomach aches. And that's so true. When a kid complains to you about my stomach hurts, and there's no reason for it, it's always worth exploring, is there anxiety or stress here? Increases in blood pressure, heart rate, things like that, sleep difficulties are going to be expected. And then suppression of the immune system. There's a public health officials will actually plan for about 3 months after a natural disaster for a big wave of infectious diseases to come through in the communities. So again, unique to our specific situation, we don't want our immune system suppressed right now. So just one more reason to check out from social media and give your nervous system some downtime. Behavioral reactions, I anticipate, especially with students, that we're going to experience some of this, more self-medicating, increase in family trouble and abuse, avoidance and isolation, and overprotective parents. So if you got lots of calls before from stressed and irritable, anxious parents, I would anticipate that those are going to increase. And that's also going to be stressful for students if they're being very overly protective of the students themselves too. So keep that in mind. And then the cognitive ones here. This is going to be very impactful in classrooms and really in athletics too, let me touch back to physical because I want to touch on athletics. In the physical reactions, when your body's under a lot of stress, you're more prone to injuries and you're more easily injured and illness. And so that is worth considering when, you know, someone's complaining about something kind of hurting, taking that into account before pushing that person too far, that it's easier to injure yourself. So over to cognitive, I think this is probably one of the most significant things that excessive stress does, is it gives you difficulty processing information, difficulty concentrating, your short-term memory does not work as well, and you have trouble making decisions, thinking clearly. All very important for the classroom and learning, you know. So the way to kind of help with this is to I call it like boxing information in, right? You try not to have all this excessive information. Don't talk just to fill time. Break things down to short, concise. This is what you need to know when it's really important and it's to the point. You know, you don't want to fill the air and fill their mind with clutter of things that aren't very important, because then the important stuff's going to get kicked out. So, I mean, really focusing in and making it simplistic. If you think of this in terms of after a natural disaster, when you're trying to help people, it's, this is where you go to get water. this is who you talk to about this. And it's like five things. This is it. This is what you got to know. And then they can go to those places to get more information, to expand upon those things. But you're just narrowing it down the best that you can for them. And in athletics, you're going to look at, you know, in plays and in routines and things like that, maybe they're not getting picked up on as quickly. Maybe you need to slow down, make it more, do it more often and break it into smaller chunks for it to be retained. If you notice that they're not retaining it like they normally would. Okay, so other ways of offering support, some skills that you need to help people. A big one is silence. And I'll talk about this a lot when I talk about social support. Support is often found in silence. So this is, if you think about animals and how many of us, you know, kind of hang out with our pets when we're stressed out and how they're just the best thing. They're kind of like better than our family sometimes, you know. And a big part of that is that they don't give us advice. They don't tell us what to do. They don't try to fix it. They just kind of sit and be there for you. And a lot of the time, that's all people need. I can't tell you how difficult it is when you first start out doing counseling and people come in, they talk and you don't get a word in. You don't say anything and they leave and they're like, oh, thank you so much. I feel so much better. You helped me so much. And you're like, I did nothing. I just sat here while you talked. And you just, it's the weirdest feeling in the entire world. Like, you can't thank me for just sitting here, but I guess whatever. But no, it's such a real thing that people just need someone to be present with them and to hear them and to feel them. And that's it. So getting good at that is definitely an essential skill. There's a Buddhists have their own approach to disaster psychology. And what they do is they go to the site of the disaster and they walk around until they find someone that looks like they're really distressed. And then they sit by them and they don't introduce themselves. They don't talk to them. They don't ask questions. They just sit there until they feel like that person feels better. And then they get up and they leave and they go find the next person. And that's it. That's their approach. So it says a lot about just the effect of just being present with somebody. And then the other skill that's really important, active listening. There's a Native American term for this. And I can't say it correctly, I'm sure, but if it says like it sounds, it's Wawokia. And that's basically means listening with the heart, which is kind of cheesy, but that's basically what it is. It's not, active listening is not the same as normal listening. When you're actively listening, you are not listening to respond. You're not listening to react. You are listening to understand and to try to feel what that person is going through. And that's all for. And so the steps to that, or the process for that, is called, what we call the I'm all ears method. And the ears is an acronym for encourage, ask questions, reflect, and summarize. The reflect and summarize, they're very similar, but they're a little bit different. When you reflect to someone, you're reflecting on what you understand about what they've just told you. So you're saying, like, what sounds like you're really upset that this happened because you feel like this. Now, they didn't say they felt that, but this is what you're gathering from what they said. And so you say that back to them. And what this says is, this points out that you are getting the undertones of what they're saying to you. That's reflection. Summarizing is when you say, like, this is like when an angry parent calls you, right? And they're like, this, and they go on for 30 minutes and you're going to have your little list, you're taking notes, you know, and you're going to say, can you tell I've sat in Angie Maddie's office a little bit? and you're going to say back to them, you're going to say, like, okay, you know, I'm understanding your concerns. What I understand is you're concerned about this. You're concerned about this. And you're going to go down your list and you're going to make sure you got all of those points that they directly told you and that you heard them. And that makes somebody feel heard. You are paying attention to them because you can say back what they told you and you can identify all of their concerns. So it's a little different than reflection. But if you can master the ears, then you're on a really good track to active listening. And then you can help to identify acceptable responses to a problem. You're going to have, question? Help to identify acceptable responses to a problem. The acceptable responses can be to change a situation, avoid a situation, or tolerate a situation. And I think of these kind of like the fight, flight, or freeze responses a little bit. So the fight is kind of like the change, like what can we do about it? Let's take care of this, you know? There's not a lot of those things right now. We can't do a lot about COVID exactly, but we can do those things about self-care, washing our hands, you know, wear your mask, do all those things you're supposed to do. Avoiding a situation is like the flight response. And I think that it gets a bad rap because people think flight people are cowardly or not facing their problems. And it's just very untrue. Avoidance can be a really smart skill and a healthy skill when used correctly. You know, like avoiding social interaction while we're staying home right now is a thing. If you had a route to work that you take all the time where there's traffic jams or car accidents and it takes you twice as long than another route, it's good problem solving to just avoid that route and go the other way, right? I mean, you could try to change it, you could try to tolerate it, but I'm going to recommend you just avoid it. It's just easier that way. And then there's tolerating a situation. If there's not much you can do about it, sometimes the best thing is just learn how to live in it and just be in it. And we're kind of doing a little bit of all three of these right now. But when someone comes to you and they're really distressed about a problem, you can think about these three things and which of these three things can we do to help them feel better about this specific problem? Change it, avoid it, or tolerate it. Okay, and then the need to evaluate for professional help. You need to be able to evaluate if someone needs to move on to something more than you can give. Some things that you can consider when trying to make that determination is, are there unpleasant symptoms that have been lasting for more than a month? Are they having difficulty functioning? If they're still going to work, school, all those things, and they're doing it, then they're functioning. If they're having a hard time even going or doing anything, then that's not normal. Concern about behaviors or emotions, risk to self or others. You feel the person's difficulties are uncomfortably beyond your skill level. So again, that self-monitoring is important. Or you feel like your need for psychological support is greater than the person you're trying to help. So those are going to be reasons you need to refer.
Jackie, we've only got about 3 minutes left.
Got it. Okay, we got two slides, so we're going to blast through this. I'm not going to read all this to you, but this is an example of the differences between distress and dysfunction. Distress is what we would consider normal for what we're going through right now. So these are the things that, if you kind of scan that list, that we're going to expect and anticipate and aren't necessarily a huge cause for alarm. And then dysfunction, that's when you want to get somebody more professional help. That's when it's moved into the realm of, this is not a normal reaction anymore. This has become excessive and is maybe dangerous to you. So if anybody wants, please let me know if you want a copy of this, these slides, and I will send them to you, and you can have a little more time to look over some of these things like this list. Okay, and lastly is my little spiel on self-care. Self-care is critical to being effective to supporting others, especially during a process like a pandemic that is as lengthy as it is. You absolutely have to take care of yourself. You have to have strategies to do that, coping skills, keeping a routine, sleeping, support from family and friends, support from family and friends is the biggest factor for helping people through psychological crisis. And so as that is going down, our ability to be around family and friends during COVID and the psychological need goes up, this is a really scary trajectory, you know? So finding ways to get support, if it's over Zoom or whatever you have to do, but to communicate with family and friends, even if it's not as effective as if it were in person, please make sure you're doing something. Avoiding self-medicating and taking breaks. And taking breaks is so important to get that nervous system down. And lastly, I just want this little quote here. I just thought this was a great way. I just stole it straight from the book because it was so perfect. I couldn't have worded it better. But It's common for people to want to push themselves until they drop, organizing their own affairs or helping others. The problem with this strategy is that the ability to be effective steadily declines with prolonged continuous work hours. Efforts expanded become less useful until a person's efforts are counterproductive or can even interfere with effective recovery. In addition, this constantly driven behavior may result in dangerous levels of physical and psychological stress on the individual. So I know that many of us have that urge to work harder and harder and harder. It seems like everything's going to fall apart if we don't, but you have to understand that if you're not rested and you're not your best self, then you can't help others be theirs. So that's all I have on this for you guys today. Like I said, if you'd like a copy of the slides, please let me know, or if you want me to come talk to your area department about it more, I'm happy to do that too. Is there any questions, Carly?
There were a couple notes in the chat.
Okay.
Some artists belong on the self-actualized list, and that Maslow cited Abraham Lincoln as a self-actualized person.
Oh, nice.
Yes, I did not know that. That came from Professor Phil in the chat. We had several requests for the slides. And as Dean Howe commented, I would imagine they're going to be posted to the center website. So we will make sure that everyone who wants a copy of this gets a copy of this awesome presentation. Did anybody else have questions? Those were the only ones that came through chat.
Okay.
Claudia says they will be posted to the center website.
All right. Thanks, everybody.
And thank you so much, Jackie.